Jaya Mishnupada Paramahansa Privrajkacharya Stathara Sathya Shishimara is the Vangashla A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Shri Prabhupada Ki. His confounder Acharya Shri Prabhupada Ki. Anantakuti Vaishnavarindi Ki. Namacharya Shri Haridas Thakur Ki. Prinsega Ho Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Viradhara Shivasri Gaura Bhaktivedanta Ki. Shishi Radha Krishna Gaura Gopakapina Shyamakina Radha Kanigri Govardhana Ki. Shri Vrindavan Dhamma Ki. Shri Mayapur Dhamma Ki, Ganga Maya Ki, Jamuna Maya Ki, Bhakti Devi Ki, Tulasi Devi Ki, Samaveta Bhakti Vrindi Ki, Janita Gaur, all glories to Sambhavatis, all glories to Sambhavatis, all glories to Sambhavatis, all glories to Shri Guru and Shri Gauranga, all glories to Shri Guru. So do you all read through the contents? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So then in the first discourse, then what we're doing is establishing the origin of the sacred law. That's what we're trying to establish, because that's the topic matter. Yeah. So in this topic matter, then for it to actually be bona fide from the Vedic viewpoint, it has to be connected to the Lord, because it's come from the Lord. Vedic doesn't actually deal if it doesn't connect to the Lord. It doesn't have any meaning otherwise. Does that make sense? That's the principle they're trying to get to. Many people may operate it that way in the Kali Yuga. You don't see it so connected, but in reality, it only has meaning if it is connected. That's the principle. So, therefore, Vyasadeva, being the incarnation of the personality of Godhead, then shows its connection. Right? So to do that, then you have to start with the Lord and then come down into the material world till you get to the point where that subject matter connects. Right? That's the first thing you have to establish. And in doing that, then you also then explain the field that it's going to function in. Because the creation is very vast. And so much detail is there. So, in general, every aspect of the creation will be explained. But the specific matter, or the specific details of the field that you need to know to operate the topic, that will be expanded more. Does that make some sense? So, therefore, we'll see now is how Manu describes it will be specifically to operate Dharma Shastra, Dharma. But other ones will operate it so that you can operate Jyotish or grammar or these other different things like that. Does that make some sense? Mm-hmm. Like that. So every scripture will open with creation. Like that. Though the modern academics, then they feel that these are interpolations because they don't see the connection with the subject because they don't consider knowledge to come from God. So for them, it's just an area to speculate on, to enjoy mental speculation, to enjoy that intellectualism, you know, something to stimulate, something interesting, something new. And that's all its purpose is, that it actually comes from God, you have to follow it, there's a standard. This they don't want to know about. Right? That's a very serious, unspoken etiquette. Is you never say this is the conclusion and it has to be followed, otherwise it's you don't know what's going on, you're wrong. That is, it's just unspoken. They have so many fields of discipline, no each one can say actually they're it. Though they have a tendency to think it. But to take it beyond that it comes from God. Yes. Yeah. Everything is relative. So therefore you look at it this way because of this, that so relativity is there. It's an important aspect, is everything's connected. But how is it relative? How could there be that you could look at it this way and look at it that way? That means there's some consistent principles that holds it together. Otherwise, you look at it this way and look at it that way, something completely different.
Right.
Does that make some sense? So that they overlook. Because the whole point is their God. Either by they intellectually control the universe, or by their science that control the universe, you know, or by the desire, or whatever it is that control the universe. That's the idea. So they miss this point. So then they'll consider that this first chapter of Mana was actually interpolated. It's been put in. That it actually at the end of this chapter, and the beginning of the next, that's the actual thing. And all this other has been put in. You know, you always have these crazy Vaishnavas always interpolating things like that. So then, so here we see is then invocation, like that, means we also remember this is just an overview so we get familiar with it. Then we'll get into it and actually go through the details, you know. Though these points that are here are the main themes. So you won't get, you'll get details more than this, but you won't get principles more than this. Does that make some sense? Okay, so Brahma's narration, the creation, so then primary. We see 1A, 1 is primary, 1A2 is secondary. Right? Primary means what Krishna himself has created before Brahma is even manifest. Right? So that's done with Garbha Dakshaya Vishnu and his eternal associates. Right? Because the Lord's never alone. Then with him, then he does the primary creation. In other words, he creates the blueprint on which everything will be created. All that then is left in the lotus stem of Brahma. And then after he manifests, then he understands what he's supposed to do. Then he takes that blueprint and then he applies it. That's why he's called the engineer of the universe. Right? But he, the engineer, uses already the bricks and the cement and the blueprint that's provided by somebody else. So Krishna's already given everything and the blueprint. Right? Then Brahma creates with that. So now in this primary creation, we'll see here down at the very last of it, 1A1.5, excuse me, 1A1 point, no, just above the end of 1.3, just above 1.4. He separated, moreover, to distinguish actions, he separated pious, impious, and the pairs of opposites such as pain and pleasure. Right? Yeah, so that is where your Dharma Shastra connects. This is the point. This is the exact point. To distinguish action, separate pious and impious and the pairs of opposites, right? Because your pious means you get good, impious means you get bad. So this is the connection, right? So the creation goes down to here, it connects. Then after that, then he starts giving details that are then useful to understand how to apply it. You understand that? Does that make some sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is the important point right there. So then we have, going back to the beginning then Karana Dakshaya manifests the universes. So then first is the creation outside. It means creation of the universes. Then you have what's going on inside. So the universe existed in the form of darkness, wholly immersed in deep sleep. Then Karana Dakshaya Vishnu appeared, dispelling the darkness. He was beyond the range of the senses, shown forth from his own will. He, desiring to create beings, first made the waters and placed the seed in them. So he's beyond everything. He's shown forth. He's transcendental. He created the Karanadak ocean. He expanded the universes into them because of his desire to create. Right?
The Pradhan, does it then come from Garbhadakshya
or Pradhan? No, that's the universe itself. The universe, what's inside, is Pradhan. So it's coming from Karana Dakshaya Vishnu. Garbha Dakshaya Vishnu then splits it into the 24 elements and then creates all the species of life and all the universe, you know, and all the planetary systems and the natures of everything. That's what he does. Karana Dakshaya Vishnu creates the energy itself. He expands the universes. So from him expands then the external potency. And then as Garbha Dakshaya Vishnu, he splits it up. And then as Kira Dakshaya, then he enters it. Means he enters it as the Paramatma. Garbhadakshaya Vishnu has already entered it as his potencies. You know what I'm saying? That something has the potency to attract, that's already Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. The Paramatma is there as the witness to see now how the jiva is going to act. You understand? Means that the general energy has come out of Karanadakshaya. Then it's specifically been split up and entered into by Garbhadakshaya. Did I say Garbhadakshaya first time? Yeah. Karanadakshaya. Yeah. Then to witness how the living entities are going to behave and to try to encourage them to go back to Godhead. Then he expands this Paramatma to go live with the living entities. Does that make some sense?
Mm-hmm.
So the attraction to the material energy and all that's coming from Garbhodakshaya. Because Garbhodakshaya Vishnu is Prajumna. So Prajumna is Cupid. So the attraction of the material world is created by him. Therefore it's attractive because Garbhodakshaya Vishnu as Prajumna in that mood of Prajumna has entered it, and therefore he makes it attractive. And because the overall element is Cupid, therefore that's why it's said it's a place of sex. That's the main chain of the material world, is that attraction. Because it all ultimately brings up to that. It's attraction to so many things, but they culminate in this. Karanadakshaya Vishnu is Shankarshan. So he establishes. Right? He removes the bad and establishes the good. So he has his expense, and then he has three moods. That of the creator, which means Hiranyagarbha, that of the maintainer, so that is Vishnu, and that is the destroyer, that's Savishi or Shambhu. Right? So in his glance it's Shambhu. So he technically enters as Shambhu. Vishnu enters, but in the mood of Shambhu. So you both have Shambhu himself who's going to consort with the external energy, which he doesn't do. But at the same time, the form of Vishnu, meaning Garbhodakshaya, who enters, is actually technically in the mood of Shambhu. Does that make sense? Because it's false ego. Because that's how the material energy functions. So in that mood, then he takes those three. The Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. So Brahma then is Jiva takes up that aspect of Hiranyagarbha. But within, that's dealing with the false ego. Then as Vishnu, then he's there. As Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, but still in that mood. And then Shiva's there to destroy.
So the glands of Mahavishnu, that's... Sadashiva.
That's Sadashiva. So technically there's no difference between Sadashiva and Lord Vishnu. Because it's just Sadashiva is Vishnu in the mood of the destroyer. But when he comes into the material energy, yeah, that is actually a transformation. That transformation then is Shiva Tattva. Because there he's still Purusha, but he's transformed, because energy has to be controlled by energetic. Like that, you can't get away from that principle. So then energy is only functions if it has a foundation. You know, like a fire doesn't, you see if the fire gets too much into the air, then it disconnects from the base, it goes out. So it has to be connected to whatever it's burning from. You know? Like that. Or electricity. It's coming, but as soon as you disconnect it from the generator, it stops. So it always has to have Purusha. So, but Krishna doesn't consort with the external energy. Right? Because he's there, his internal potency is there, he's like the sun. So when he shines on the internal potency, that's going to create a shadow on the other side. Does that make sense? So that's the external potency. Right? It's just inherent. If you have light, you have to have darkness. So if the light shines at any object, then you'll get darkness. So Krishna is the supreme subject, Radharani is the supreme object. So that light shining there will create a shadow. So that shadow is the external potency. But the shadow also has to be connected to Purusha. So he doesn't directly deal, he transforms. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So therefore, the whole mood within the material energy is that of false ego. Because it's all because of that element of Sankarshan, because he's created the whole thing. Right? Sankarshan is the expansion of Balaram. So Sankarshan is that element of ego. He's the lord of false ego. Right? Vasudeva is the lord of how you say, the pure goodness, pure consciousness. Sankarshan of ignorance, of the ego. Prajumna of passion, or of the senses, something like that, and the intelligence. And Aniruddha then is the mind and the mode of goodness. Like that. So these four, so there's four kinds of ego that you're dealing with in the universe. Like that. First is polluted consciousness. From that, then it creates the gross identity. Right? Because the false ego is connected with your body. Then, next one down is the intelligence, the senses, and then finally is the mind. So the mind is the central, is the pivot. From the mind, that's how you access the pure consciousness. Does that make some sense? It means you have, if you look at it, you have the ego is above. Right, of the eight elements, it's the highest, but it's connected with the five gross elements, which are the lowest, right? Because your body is made out of the five gross elements. So you take the eighth element and the lower five elements. Does that make sense? That's the mode of ignorance. Then you have the next one down's intelligence, that's passion, and that connects to the senses, which are then in the body. And then in the middle, between these two, is the mind, which is the mode of goodness. Like that. So the mind, through the mind, you get at the consciousness. Because in the mind, then you have, in the core of that, is either the pure or polluted consciousness. So the consciousness is pure, then your identity is that as a devotee, you know, not the body. So therefore the body is not the function, it's purified. Then your intelligence is then used to serve Krishna, your senses are used to serve. And then the mind accepts and rejects, accepts those things that are favorable and rejects those things unfavorable. Does that make sense? That's how it works. So, therefore, then you get Karana Daksha Vishnu. You know, then comes in as Sankarshan. Right? So then that aspect of the ego is there. Then Garbha Daksha Vishnu, expands into everything, and then Kiradakshaya Vishnu, then he establishes what is the standard. So he's the one that's followed, right? He sets the standard, like that. He's the example, like that. So you always have these four aspects of Godhead functioning. In Vasudeva is the leader. He comes and performs his pastimes. So here, then we see he's done that. So Karana Daksha Vishnu's part, he's desired, he's beyond the creation, and he's desired to make it. He made the waters, means the Karana Daksha ocean, and put his seed there, which is the universes, by breathing out and coming out of his pores. Right, then we have Garbha Daksha. The seed became a golden egg. He then entered it, the creator of the world. As the water, Nara, is his residence, Ayana, he is named Narayana. Right? That's how you get the name Narayana. From Garbha Daksha Vishnu is produced, from Karana Daksha Vishnu is produced Garbha Daksha Vishnu. Now we see is now the rest of it is now Garbha Daksha. The Divine One resided in that egg for a year, then he divided it into two halves. Right? Means it was the empty part and then the waters. Like that. He then created heaven, earth, the middle sphere, eight directions, and the Garbhodak ocean. The mind, which is both real and unreal, and the ego, having self-consciousness. Real and unreal means it actually exists, it can perceive reality, but at the same time it can throw on it by its perception something unreal. Right? You take a green piece of paper with faces on it and say, this is valuable. So that's unreal. Right? It's just you value it, so it's put on there. You know, you take one tin can, you know, and you sell it for $350,000, right? Another tin can, you sell it for $5,000, right? The only basically is just one tin can's, you know, a little more care has gone into it. You call it a Rolls Royce, and the other tin can is, you know, just some ordinary car, like that. But they're both tin cans, you know. That's actually just, you know, one's a nicer lined tin can and the other one's, you know, not so nicely lined. But we put the value on it. But actually it's a tin can. You know, with four, you know, rubber wheels. Like that. So we put the value on it like that. You know what I'm saying? It's like you have a pair of pants. This year they're in fashion. Everybody says they're great. Next year no one will even look at them. The pants exist, so that's real. But what you decide that this is in fashion or not, that's unreal. Because that's just transitory illusion. Material energy exists, like this wall exists. But now if we say this is good or bad or nice or not nice or all these dualities, that's what's unreal.
So the value you put on it is unreal.
Yeah.
But the object is real.
Yeah. But, so therefore you want to bring the perception and the value system in line with actual reality. So Krishna is real. So his values and what he places on it is valuable. That's real. So the whole Dharma Shastra is to teach you what is Krishna's perception and what does he finds as valuable to it. Yes.
You put value to it according to gunas, and you should just operate pure gunas, so that would be according to Krishna.
Yeah, that's it. So that's the whole idea, is that the thing may operate through one of the modes. It's always the way it is. If anything's being created, like you're cooking, it's passion. If anything's being destroyed, like you're washing the pot and getting the dirt off, that's ignorance. You know, like that. That you're doing it, you're maintaining it, so that's goodness. You know, and at the same time as you're creating a shiny pot, so therefore that's passion. So all the modes are all interacting together. But the point is you can either be yourself entangled in that, or you can be transcendental in pure goodness. Can, yeah. But at the same time, it depends what you're trying to do. Now, if you're trying to get from point A to point B in the quickest way possible, then that one's not suitable, because it you know, even its best can never do more than, you know, 120 kilometers. But you may have another car, it can do 200 kilometers. So therefore, that would be more valued. You know, or it may be nice, it's that, but you're out on the battlefield, you know, all it takes is, you know, one grenade in your history, you know, so you want something that, you know, is, you know, very thick and all that, and burns up tons of gas and pollutes like anything, but keeps you alive. So that's the whole thing, is depending on time, place, and circumstances, you'll judge. So now, how you would actually make a proper value and judgment, then that's best done according to Krishna's standards. So then, even though the modes it's dealing with may be impassioned goodness or ignorance, but your consciousness in engaging in the Lord's standards is pure goodness. Yeah. So therefore, you get purified of those modes and get liberated. So that's the beauty of the system, is you are using mundane energy, but because it's dealt with in Krishna's service, therefore you're liberated by that process. Well, the jnanis have to give up any contact with the material energy to get liberated. And technically it's only heard of that people get liberated. Right? But the only people I've ever heard of that have actually been liberated on the transcendental platform are Sukadeva Goswami, the four Kumaras, and the demons killed by Krishna. If you really think about it, there's no one else who you hear of is actually, you know, in Brahman realization.
Not even Maitreya Rishi?
May, but he's a devotee. It means they may be transcendental. Most were purely liberated transcendentalists. Brahman realized transcendentalists who are not devotees. Yeah, pure impersonalists. You only hear of those ones, and then two of them become devotees. Right? Because someone on that platform, if they come in contact with the Lord, they'll just take it up, because they know they're not material, so this is giving pleasure, so then they'll take it, because they know it's not material. Like that. While those who are not, those who are below that, won't take it because they think it's material. That's the Maya bodies. They take it even though it's transcendental, because it's form and shape and all this. pleasure, happiness, they'll immediately say, no, it's material, because they can't tell the difference. So they're technically not transcendentalists, because they can't really tell what's transcendental. They have a glimmer that Brahman is transcendental, but that's about it. But they really don't know what Brahman is. Because if Brahman's Brahman, you don't have to do anything to Brahman for it to be Brahman. It already is Brahman. You have to become Brahman. So that means they don't actually understand who they are, what is Brahman. You know? Brahman's already Brahman. So the soul is Brahman's Brahman, the material energy is Brahman, is already Brahman, and the Lord is Brahman. Just he's the supreme Brahman. Then the jivas are our next Brahman below that, and then the material energy is the lowest form of Brahman. But it's all Brahman. So you don't have to transform it into Brahman, it already is.
In a way, it also doesn't make sense with the oneness, because you're in the oneness, but you experience.
Yeah, you can't experience if it's one.
No.
Experience means two.
Yeah,
so like that, there's too many contradictions, but it keeps them busy. The main point is it keeps them off the street. You know? So that's the whole thing you're trying to do. Is better they're doing that, then their trouble is limited. It's a demoniac mentality, but at least it's engaged so that others who are devotees can function. You know, like
that.
Yeah, like that. But it's just like you go to an impersonalist ashram as a devotee, you know, you go to any of these places where they are, they'll give you a place to stay, they'll feed you, they'll take care of it, they'll respect you because of the culture, because of the commonality of the Vedic, and that you're, you know, going for transcendence. To get into some discussion, there may be a bit of difference like that, but otherwise, culturally, then everybody can interact. You know, Duryodhana, who's a demon, can interact with God, you know, Krishna, and invite him, sit him down, feed him, and this and that, and interact. But it doesn't mean that he actually gets any benefit, because he's inimical. But the culture is that. Jarasandha also. You know, he's inimical to all three of them. But because of the culture, then he can host them and take care of them and interact. So it makes for pleasant interaction. Like that, so that the devotees can still function and live their natural culture. So that's why it's there. So, okay. Then, creation of the field. Now we get down to what is going on, that are the elements by which the Dharma Shastra will be applied. Right? So these have to be in place. Then you can establish Dharma Shastra. Right? Because Dharma Shastra is regulating something. So you already have to create the field that is regulating. Right? You know, until you have numbers, you can't have a mathematical calculation. Right? So arithmetic is based on the principle that numbers exist. So when you create the concept of numbers, then you can next create arithmetic. Once you've created arithmetic, then you can create algebra, geometry, and trigonometry. Right? Because that's based on arithmetic. Does that make sense? Like that. So the concept of numbers has to be there. Then the numbers. Then the ways to engage the numbers. So that's what's going to happen now. Then he created heaven, earth, middle sphere, eight directions, and the Garbhodak ocean. The mind which is both real and unreal, and the ego, and having self-consciousness. Mahabhuta means the five elements. Those affected by the three modes and the five sense organs. By these six, the subtle particles of Mahabhuta and ego, he created all beings. So by ego and the five elements, he created all the beings, because they think they're the bodies, so that's what's been created here, is all the bodies that are created. All those, as those six particles enter Ashri, these creatures, the body is called Sharira. Right? Means Sharira means that the particles have entered, so therefore that's why it's called Sharir. Because these six have entered it. Mahabhuta's subtle forms and functions with the mind enter the body. So the subtle forms are then the mind, intelligence, and false ego. The world comes from these seven, the six plus the mind, the gross from subtle. So everything gross always comes from subtle. So if it's manifest, then there's a subtle form to it. Like that, it exists. So there's no such thing as doing something you don't want to do, because there's in the mind, it's already there. So if you want to get rid of the activity, you have to get rid of the desire for it. Yeah, that's it. You know, you're saying, oh, I don't want to think about this. But you do, that's why it's there. If you didn't, it wouldn't be there. like that. Material energy isn't going to waste your time. It means you've been thinking about these things for so long, and you're habituated to, so therefore that functions that way. She's not going to, because otherwise she can't keep anyone in Maya by getting to think about things that they couldn't care about. You know what I'm saying? Like if you don't like, you know, eating potatoes, she's not going to have you sitting there dreaming about fabulous potatoes, because it won't have any effect. But a person who likes potatoes, then they'll always be thinking about them. Even if they're told don't eat them because you become fat, you know, but still they think about it because they like potatoes. Does that make sense? So that's the thing. So when there's something you don't like that's there, then you have to look at it and go, well, actually, why is it there? Because I do like it. So therefore, why do I like it? You know, why shouldn't I like it? Why do I like it? Then try to get the two to come together. You know, I like it, but I shouldn't like it because of this. So therefore, then you have to balance it. That I shouldn't like it because it's detrimental in this way. I like it because I think I'm going to get some benefit out of it. But if you analyze, the benefit doesn't exist. But the bad does exist. Right? It means the real and unreal. The bad is actually real, and what I think I'm going to get is the unreal. Then you can remove it from the mind. Then the mind, because as soon as his mind is accept and reject, it accepts that which it sees as favorable, it rejects those that it doesn't see as favorable. So as soon as it actually understands that it's unfavorable, the mind will just drop it. But until, if it thinks there's any glimmer to get something of value out of it, then it will keep it. Does that make sense? Like that.
Say, like bad habits. You know, you understand.
Yeah.
Like smoking cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
You understand it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
And your intelligence knows it's bad. Your mind knows it's bad. You still have to do it.
Because the value is still there. Because you know it's bad, but you're getting pleasure out of it. So until the bad outweighs the good, that you call good, your pleasure, you won't drop it. So you either have to replace it with something better, or the bad has to so much outweigh the bad, the good. You know, it's just like you're smoking and all that, and yeah, you know, it's bad and this and that, then your friend gets cancer. Then it's kind of like, okay, the bad outweighs the good. Then you give it up.
Yeah.
Or you find something else to keep you busy that you don't need the smoking. Like that. So something has to do. So the Vedic thing is first regulate. Because if it's irregulated, then it's always when you want. Therefore, then when you want it, then you will find the most pleasure in it. Right? So if you regulate it, that okay, you know, you have a bad habit, then you only do it at this time. Then that means there's all these times that you want it, but you can't have it because it's the wrong time. But you survived. You didn't die. You know, life went on. So then the mind starts to see, I can live without it. Then at the time when it's there, because you're supposed to have it at that time, then it's no big deal. Because something's only fun when you're not supposed to have it. And so in this way, then you slowly, the mind gets convinced that, okay, this is not important. So that's why the first thing is if you can understand it by philosophy, just get rid of it. If you can't, then regulate it. And then by that regulation, you know, for a higher purpose, then gradually, the mind will just drop it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Which place in the sequence an element occupies that many qualities it has? Right? Means the ether is the first in the sequence, so it has one. The air has two. The fire has three. Water has four. And earth has five. Right? It means which was created first. So ether has sound. Air has sound and touch. Fire has sound, touch, form. Right? Water has sound, touch, form, taste. And earth has sound, touch, form, taste, smell. Like that. So each one as it comes out has one more quality. As the Lord created the universe, so the Veda describes. So exactly as it says in the Shastra, that's how the Lord created it. And exactly how the Lord created it, that's what it says in the Shastra. Because He's the source of the universe, He's the source of the Shastra. So therefore, they're not inconsistent. So one should never doubt the scriptures. If the scripture says, this is what a man thinks in this situation, this is the way he is, or that's the way a woman is, or this is the nature of money, or land, or passion, or ignorance, that's the way it is. So if we don't understand it, that's us. You know, it's just like you go to learn something from a teacher, you don't understand it, then only a foolish person says, oh, the teacher doesn't know what they're talking about. Right? No, everybody says the teacher knows what they're talking about, you just haven't understood the principle or the concept yet, or the detail. So it's just a matter of applying yourself, then you'll understand. But the tendency is because the speculativeness and the impersonalness, then we put our own intelligence in that above the scriptures. So if we don't understand it, we say it's not like that. Right? Because we don't understand it, because then we don't understand how I'm going to get my benefit out of it, because I only see loss. I see loss of freedoms, I see loss of sense gratification, loss of happiness, loss of my whole value system, my whole identity falls apart. So what's trying to happen is we're trying to if one's accepted that the Vedic principle is right, and that we're servant of Krishna, and the process is bhakti, right, under the direction of the acharyas, then what the acharyas give us, we accept. And if we can't understand immediately, we try to apply it. And by that trying to apply it, then we get success. Right? But if it's rejected, it's foolish, because Krishna made the place and he wrote the books, he wrote the manual. Prabhupada always gives the example that a manufacturer creates an object and then makes a manual on how to operate it. You know, so the manual's right. You know, you can't say, no, it doesn't work. It's not that you have to push the start button to go, you know, you just give it a whack on the side, you know. Because maybe one time the button was stuck, they whacked it, it worked. Yeah, you just whack it, and then they can't figure out why it doesn't work. You know? So then, like that. So that's a very important principle. He, the Lord, also created the gods, the sadhus, and the eternal sacrifice. The sadhus are like the sages. For sacrifice, the Rig, Yajras, and Samavedas appeared from fire, wind, and sun. So Rig is fire, Yajra is wind, and Sama is sun. He then desired to call into existence time, stars, planets, rivers, oceans, mountains, plains, and uneven ground. So you see, before this was all the concepts and all the sacrifice and everything, so it hasn't gotten to the earth yet. Right? It hasn't gotten to the situation in which actually people live. So he's created the people, he's created the subtle things of which you make people, you know, the gross things from which you make the people, then he's created the actual different kinds of, you know, the elevated people. Then he creates the situations in which the people live. Right? Time influences everybody. Stars, then the stars and nakshatras, then they control your life. Planets control your life. The rivers, oceans, mountains, plains, and uneven ground. These are different places where auspicious things are performed, by which are the things where you get the ingredients for performance of sacrifice. So in other words, everything here you see is connected to sacrifice.
What's the very conception of star? Is that a planet?
Star is nakshatras, the constellations.
Oh, it's a constellation of planets?
The 27 constellations.
Asterisk.
Asterisk, constellations. It means the moon moves through all these constellations. It means in one zodiac sign there's 2.5 constellations. So like that. They're all wives of the moon.
So it's more like a position. Star.
It's a position, but there actually are planets there. So that particular group of planets then is one of the moon's wives.
Yeah. So it's not like that you say that the stars are suns.
No, they're different planets that are there. Because they have their own, you know, particular effulgence, so they reflect the effulgence of the sun.
Right.
But then those means other planets, other stars are planets. So the different, you know, you, how you say, different planetary systems. You know, where all the different sages and different great personalities live and all that. So from here we know them as stars. You know, but when you go up there, you actually see the planets and all the people living on them. Mm-hmm. Like that. So from here you see stars, but if you go up through, then you start, you get close and see the different planetary systems and different residents on them and all that. So both. But the stars here, many times it means the nakshatras. Because then that, those are the stars that actually influence your life. The other ones don't.
Yeah. I don't know if it fits in here, but it's about Vedic cosmology. That's how I put it once. Well, for example, Milk Ocean or the Yogurt Ocean, that's not actual yogurt as you buy conscious. It's a solid form or whatever.
You can have that, but I would say there's the gross, because he's talking about multidimensional. It means the gross and the subtle is there at once. Because you have the movement of the planet. Let's say Mars moves here, that creates that. But underneath that is actually the gross. Because subtle is there, what's the use of subtle unless it creates the gross? Because there's people that can go to that yogurt ocean and take yogurt out. They may be subtle like that, but they can actually do it. So it's not subtle, it's just a mental concoction.
This thing is, this boom underlies rather the ecliptic. And you can see the stars. One part of the sky is not simply black and white out because the light doesn't go through the yogurt.
No, boom mandalas goes this way. So we can only see part of it. But they go way out here. Where we are, these oceans are way out beyond us. They're beyond the Bhugola. We are only on part of the edge of the salt ocean. Salt ocean is 80,000 miles. This planet's only 25,000. And so the salt ocean is actually technically only half. It means it only comes up to the equator. But the sons of Sagar Maharaj have looked for the horse, dug around more, and so the ocean has come in more. But otherwise, before that, it didn't come in more. So they've dug all this. So that means actually we only know 12,000 miles, 12,000 to 14,000 miles of the salt ocean. There's more of it. But it's just like you have an ant in this room, it can only see so much. So because we're depending on this for pratyaksha, our eyes, and even though you're using, you know, these big, powerful, you know, instruments, we're still using our eyes. So there's things there that may be happening we can't perceive. Yeah, because all these dimensions are there, but we can't see them. But they exist. And for someone else, that's their gross existence. Like our existence of this room, that for an ant walking around, there is not this class going on, there's not an academy, there's not the Mayapur project, there's not the ISKCON, there's not the mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So it exists, but in their perception, it doesn't. So that's the same way. So you say different dimensions is the perception. The great sages, they can walk from here right up to Brahmaloka. They can go through all these things. For them, we can't. Because we're conditioned. Prabhupada says, Narad Muni, because he's not conditioned, he can fly into space. Because he doesn't think, I can't do it. But we think we can't do it, so therefore we're stuck here. If we understood we don't have to be, then we can move from here. But it's a particular level of consciousness. And so that's not inherent in the conditioned human being. So you can only see so much. Even if you see it, you don't see it. You know? That's the whole point, is you see what you want to see. You know, it's like on that book on the forbidden archaeology. So much evidence is there to point to something else, but they can't see it. Even though it's there. There's stuff to prove modern man's always been there, and the Aborigines have always been there. They're there today. Modern man is there today, there's an Aborigine there today. You know? Like this. So all these new forms of life are still there, and original forms of life are still there. Right? If it's all, why are there, you know, as many, you know, amoebas and, you know, one-celled things, is there, you know, there's more of them than anything. So if everything moved on, then what happened? You know? Is I telling here about the whales? What did he say? He said, why don't you learn to swim? Oh, okay. It's just they just don't see. So you have both things happening at once. There is actually an ocean that you can go there, it's full of yogurt. At the same time, because of dimension here means perception. It's not like you have first, second, third dimensions, and then there's a fourth. No, there's only three directions. You know, there's only this way, you know, frontwards, backwards, right to left, and up and down. You know, everything else is a combination of those. So as far as space goes, that's how it works. But what fits in the space, that's a matter of perception. The demigods are standing there. You can't see them. They allow you to see them. You can see them. God's standing there. You don't see him. You see a stone. He wants you to see him. Then you'll perceive. So the dimensions are like that. You have to use some term that the scientists can clutch onto. But at the same time, we know it goes beyond the scientist's definition. Because the scientist's definition isn't enough. So dimension is the only word they have, so that's what we use. But all those oceans exist. You know? Just like the lords of those planets are Vishnumurtis. Right? And so then, does that make some sense? So you have the deity, then you have the planet, then you have that influence that it has, then you have that mandala. You know, so if you really knew the whole science, you could probably check and see the connection of the deity, that planet, and the nature of the residence of that mandala. And you'd probably see some similarities. But science can't do that for you. You'd have to go back into the Vedic and you have to expand it. Because from any one thing, you can't get the complete answer. Because it's not everything, all information is not given in one science. Like you have so many details of, you know, one topic in another topic. Like Ayurveda describes the proper way to present a discussion. Right? And you say, well, what does that got to do with Ayurveda? Ayurveda means to have the proper complete health of the organism. The organism includes the intelligence. Mm-hmm. So, unless a discussion is proper, the intelligence can't be healthy. So therefore, it will describe that then. So then, Nyaya will give other technical things, but just how the intelligence is working will be over on this side. Because Nyaya is just how to apply it. It's not what is the intelligence or mind. So like that is you need to cross many to actually get the full picture.
Yeah, but 18 manas, 18 puranas in the tower, 18 stones were thrown in the pond of knowledge, and those rings all crossing each other on different places going over the whole pond.
You could put it that way.
But there's different ways, different centers.
Yeah, you could, but actually they're all one center. So you can drop 18 stones and it'll create 18 different wave things, but they're all happening at the same time. Just like if you drop one stone, it'll make one wave. That will go across the lake and it'll come back while the waves are still going out.
Right.
And then hit again. So you can have, like when Krakatoa blew up, there were 7 layers of waves going because it went around the planet 7 times. So that means waves are going under waves under waves. So that means you can have 18 waves all happening at once because Krishna will always be the center.
Yeah. But 18 Puranas have...
But they're all saying the same thing. Because the stories, they all use the same main stories. It's just that they explain it for the particular audience. Like that. So 6 of them describe it. Well, that means, in other words, they'll take a particular deity and focus on them more. And then within that, depending on who they're talking to and what their purpose is, then they'll explain it from that angle. but the stories are all the same. The same basic body of stories is what's described in all of them. Yeah, but there will be some difference in the angle that they'll describe it from. You know, like it. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Then came, okay, plains and uneven ground. So then certain things are good for doing. You do your austerities in the mountains, you do your sacrifice. This is even ground. Uneven ground is not used, but the herbs and everything will grow there for your sacrifices. So, in other words, it's all based around sacrifice. You see, the main thing that's going on here is what's engaged. You're going to engage the body, mind, and words in the Lord's service through the Dharma Shastras. You're going to perform sacrifice. You're going to have to need the Vedic mantras in all the different places where they can be performed. So that's why this particular group is being explained. It means it's common principles, but it's some sub-details it won't describe. But another Shastra will describe it more because it has a different purpose. Austerity, speech, pleasure, desire, anger, and the whole creation. So austerity is what you get everything by. Speech is there, pleasure, desire, through that you get everything. Anger is what has to be controlled, and it comes to frustration after desire, and the whole creation. However, moreover, to distinguish actions, he separated pious, impious, and the pairs of opposites, such as pain and pleasure. So that's the connection now. Now we've connected in Dharma Shastra. By subtle perishable particles of the five elements, this whole world is created. So that sums up this whole thing. So, by the subtle of the eight elements, like that, therefore everything's created from that. Right? In that eight elements, we'll put the mind. I mean, in the mind, we'll put all the senses, sense objects, and the tan matras. Right? Because you have earth. You have the sense of smell, and you have smell itself, you know, the sense that actually does the smelling. So all that will be included in the mind.
Like that.
Means pious and impious is established by God, then you can desire pious or impious activities. It's the field in which to act. We don't create the pious and impious. It already exists. But we value it, so we perform pious, or we value impious, we perform that. Or we don't bother with either, we go into transcendental. Right? Since we have to do something, we have a gross body. You know, so our body, mind, and words then are material. So we have to use material elements. So of that, then the pious elements are considered a better quality than impious. So generally we will use the pious elements in the Lord's service as opposed to the impious. Yes.
You could also say that the Dharma is meaningless unless it's in terms of right and wrong. So when the duality is coming right and wrong, then Dharma comes.
Yeah. You already have to be able to tell, because Dharma means what's right. Okay. And distinguish you right from wrong and doing what's right. Right. So that's Dharma. But therefore, it's mundane, because it's here. You know, in the spiritual world, they have variety, and you can distinguish that variety. There, everything's good, because everything's used in the Lord's service. But still, for rasa, then to taste a particular rasa, there's a particular path it takes. So it'll only move through certain elements of the transcendental. Because if it moves through a different path and mixes path, then you get mixed rasa. You get rasa pas. So that principle then reflects here as pious and impious activities. But here it's just distinguishing what's good for making, you know, what's profitable and what's not profitable. So in other words, it boils almost down to the application of economics. So that's why if religion is used for economics, then it's kind of a lower end of it. So it becomes more morality. But real religion then means engaging it in the Lord's service. And that will give you liberation. So if you just perform it because it's good and it will give you good activities, it'll end up in artha and kama. If you perform it for the Lord, then then its side benefit is liberation. That means by performing the religious process in the Lord's service, it will liberate you from material energy. Like that. But it won't give you prema. Right? Prema comes from the direct activities of chanting, hearing, chanting, remembering. Those acts, the nine processes of devotional service. That will give you prema. But engaging the varnashram, that will liberate you from the material world so that you don't have any conditioned nature to hold you back from developing that prema. So that's why the two go together. That's the process. Is that never always remember Krishna? That's the direct activities of devotional service. Never forget Krishna. That's engaging the material energy in the Lord's service. Yeah, or yama and niyama. What's favorable, what's unfavorable. Like this. Well, it means you have this in all elements. Is what's favorable for. So in other words, those that are directly favorable, those are transcendental. Then there's those that are quite favorable. Then there's those who are neutral. So generally the Vedic, most of it is neutral. Some of it's more direct. But the essence of it is transcendental. It's Bhagavat. Bhagavat is the process. But for the conditioned soul, then it comes down to us as Pancharatra, and then supporting that as Vedic. So that's the order. Bhagavad is purely transcendental, no conditioned considerations. Pancharatra is transcendental, but it takes into consideration how to regulate the conditioned soul so that they can engage in transcendence. And the Vedic then purely deals with the conditioned nature. And if you know what you're doing, you'll use it for the Lord, so then it becomes an instrument for transcendental upliftment. And if you don't, then you'll use it for pious activities, for heavenly enjoyment. And if you ignore it, then hell is there. Keep you busy. Also, keep you off the streets. Right? Okay, then 1A14, the inherent nature of all created beings. That nature the Lord allotted to each being is assumed in each later creation. In other words, each creation, each of the 8,400,000 species of life is exactly the same nature. It doesn't change. So a dog in this creation, after the dissolution, when again the Lord breathes out and he, in the primary creation, creates dogs, it'll be exactly the same. The same dogs, the same nature. The same fish, same nature. Same birds, same nature. Same bee, it's all the same. That's why I said chewing the chew. Yeah. So it's like that. So the nature of the dog is inherent. It's always been there. So this idea that it's developed, you know, somehow the amoeba decided that, you know, if it had teeth, it would be better for it, you know.
The amoeba grew legs and learned to talk.
It's all there, but still, anything is like that. It means any form you have, it's already there. Any art form that's there, there's eternal principles. So no one's doing up anything new. They're just using their intelligence to apply it. Right? Means you have a form. Then in that form, you can adjust within that. Then it's called that form. Right? If you take seven notes and adjust that around, it's called music. You know, if you take steps, then it's called dance. You know, if you imitate things, it's called drama. You know, but you can come up with it. You can take seven notes and come up with unlimited melodies. But those seven notes, no musician created. And the concept that music even exists, no musician ever created. Same with art. There's already an inherent concept of aesthetics. It's based on balance. So you can have a direct symmetrical balance or you can have an asymmetrical balance. But it has to be balanced. Otherwise it's not art. So that no one's created, that God's created. But within that, then you can bring up this aspect, that aspect. That's how you get a form. You know, you call the music, it's Baroque, or it's romantic, or it's rock, or it's jazz, or it's, you know, classical, or it's, you know, because of it's the main field in which it functions. You know, architecture, you can say, okay, this is Greek, or this is Roman, or this is, you know, so many different things you'll say, because it follows particular vernacular. But the point is just doing that, there's still some pleasure in that. You know, you have a classical musician, all he does is read off a score and plays the same thing they've been playing for hundreds of years, and they find pleasure in it. They feel like an artist. They don't have to create it, you know?
It's still a talent.
Yeah, it's still, because you have to, it's your interpretation.
Still get a pass.
So when you play an instrument and you play like someone who wants to play good, I mean, that gives you a sense of accomplishment.
Yeah. Because it's good.
If you can do what they did.
Yeah. It means God created it like this, so if you can copy that, it's not bad. You know? So it's because the point is we're instruments anyway. God's created anyway. Even whatever anybody does, it's there. They're only able to be the instrument because they think they're the doer. Therefore, then they take the credit and take the result. So either they get the good or bad from it. But if one is not, you know, then it's different. So when somebody does the most inspired work is generally when they're not trying to create; they're letting it happen, right? But then they take the credit for it afterwards. You know, to tell them that was a great performance. And then this, yes. You know, like that. But it's actually, it was only great because they weren't doing it. They were just allowing what's inherent there in the modes of nature did it. You know? These are all eternal kind of principles. All these kind of musics, it's just when you have a certain level of consciousness, that's what comes out. You drop it a little bit more, then another comes out. You drop a little more, then another one comes out. So that's all. So means between one and the other, the Sunday, it looks kind of the same, you know, or that's fusion, whatever, then it turns into something different. And then you'll spot, okay, this is this form, this is this form, this is this form. Then you give names to it. Like that. But this kind of music, these forms of life, these kind of dresses, all every Kali Yuga, they do exactly the same thing. You know? That's all. Because the point is the living entities have these desires.
So if you said that because consciousness is the same, activity will be the same because consciousness is kind of predictable from consciousness alone.
Yeah. Just like you look at some of the, I don't know if it's still now, but I think it was maybe a year, 2 years ago I was looking at it. They wear their sunglasses, but they get into these more bigger kind of bubbly sunglasses. And then the kind of cloth they wear is generally like kind of these kind of like acrylics, really smooth and shiny. And then they use patchwork fluorescent colors. They're generally in geometric kind of asymmetrical designs. Right? And that's very popular. Right? You look at a bug, that's what a bug wears. Right? They got, you know, bug eyes, right? They look like sunglasses. You know, and they got smooth, shiny skin with fluorescent colors, and it's always in some kind of wild geometric patterns. You know, so it's, you know what I'm saying? So when the consciousness gets to that level, that's what looks attractive. You know, when it's more beastly, then you see they get into more fuzzy, furry, you know, kind of like earthy, yeah, earthy colors and stuff like that. So depending on, you know, they get more birdie, then they get into other, you know, more slick back, you know, things that, you know, that's the bird. So then they move through all these different consciousness, and so you see all these different fashions and stuff come back. You know, birds have, you know, these great 1930s haircut, you know, it's short and kind of greased back, not too long, you know, that's the bird cut, you know. You know. And so then you have, you know, when it's a little longer and you part it down the middle, that's the monkey cut. You know, because that's the way the monkey's hair are. You know, so it's just like, it's just you come like. I saw one thing, I think it was a Bennington commercial. advertisement. They had some guy. He might have been a very light colored black, you know? And he had a nose pin. And he was turned sideways. And the way he had his hair, you know, they do it in a different color, and the way it was kind of standing up and stuff like that. Thing was straightened out. He looked like a bird. You know, because he had a really kind of big pointy nose with a little hole, because the birds always have that hole in the end of the nose. And then the hair, sometimes they had a little tuft on the top. He looked exactly like a bird. So these things are just common. When the consciousness goes there, then it puts it. So then that consciousness is there, so it comes up at this particular point in the Kali Yuga. Different one will come up later. So you'll always have this change and all those things. And because people, they can go through something for millions of years. Like it says that the yogi is drilling their respiration for millions of lifetimes. Then they still can't see the lotus feet of the Lord. So you're a karmi for so long, then a jnani for so long, then a yogi for so long, and then you're like a Buddhist or Jain like this, and then, you know, then you start all over again. So you got to keep living and being busy. Right?
Mm. What about like bodies who they were, you know, not even jnani or karmi, like teachers, and then now bodies? What about chance?
Because bhakti is something different.
So it's not that you have to go through karma again to get to bhakti.
No, we've already done all that. I mean, this is, you know, when you've been in the material since time immemorial, then, you know, it's been that plenty of times. Yeah, you've done it quite a few times. Because everybody comes in as Brahma, and then it's downhill from there.
Uh-huh.
So we've been in every species of life.
We have.
I mean, someone is a devotee. Done everything and has figured out there's something wrong here. Not getting the taste I want, you know? And so that's why then they take it up. So that's why it's foolish for them to go back into it. You know, that there's something still there. No, you've already chewed it. And then it's going, well, I don't know, man. I could chew it over there. I'll chew it on the other side, you know? You know? I won't chew it with my mouth open. I'll keep my mouth closed. Maybe I'll get some more. I drink a little water with it and moisten it, maybe I'll get some taste out of it. You know,
does that mean that die-hard materialists who just want to enjoy and don't want to hear about anything transcendental, they're like newer souls?
Or? Can be, or just, they're just, it doesn't mean that, but they just still have that determination they're going to get something out of it. It just means the devotees have figured out, nope, nothing's here. So they at least have a doubt. Maybe they don't understand it, but they have a doubt that there's something wrong here. Everybody says you do all these things, you enjoy, I'm doing it, I'm not enjoying, something's wrong here. You may have no idea what or why. And so when you come in contact with the devotees, so then when you ask why, then Paramatma puts you in contact with the devotees.
Yeah, that's the first thing I say to my head. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so then it says at some point, every devotee is asked why. That's why they come in contact. Like that.
Does it mean association with devotees is missed in the society? Like let's say that few centuries ago, so that Krishna provides some soft religious moments?
No, it means there's always a pure devotees around. You always have it.
Like
at any time.
In the West, in Europe.
But the souls who have no interest, then they end up over there. You know, but even there, they can come in contact. You have that German guy who came in contact and came to initiate the disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. You know, he can come from anywhere. You know, there's a little interest, but it wasn't a pure interest. So they had, you know, that one lady from Chicago then, you know, took shelter of local Bengali, you know, sadhu, like that. You know, so you can come in contact anywhere. These things of the Orient have been around for a long time. It may be new for a lot of the devotees just because they're moving in very general, you know, families who just deal kind of in the day-to-day stuff. But all this, what nowadays you call New Age, That was actually very popular in the 20s and 30s. But it was an underground, more kind of avant-garde, out of the way. And those people all considered very weird. But that these magazines people read now, UFO, 40 and Times, those are all established. UFO is more modern, but 40 and Times is from the 30s.
But couldn't also the other forms of religion also be also used?
Yeah, of course, of course. Means, yeah, means.
So even in the Western countries, there were saintly Christians, or there,
yeah,
and the association with those individuals gave them a certain amount of faith, which, yeah, brought them to the next level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of understanding. So wherever you are, in Bhagavatam, when I was in school, I would always show it to my friends. But in the second chapter of the first canto, last verse, 2:28, and Srila Prabhupada said how Supreme Lord, he incarnates in every society, every species, mm-hmm, every culture to gradually uplift them. So, but just adding to it, everybody has some sort of, mm-hmm, association, mm-hmm, to help them move forward, mm-hmm, at all times, even the insects.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, and it blew my mind when I read it.
All species. It's
all species. That's what Srila Prabhupada, every
species. Okay, so the Lord incarnates in every species, because the inherent nature of the species has to be given by the Lord, so he's incarnated in all of them.
Mm.
I was reading somewhere, maybe in Shringer, that I was talking about the mosquito incarnation. It's very short, you know, just the Lord came, you know, was sitting there and buzzing around, and then all the demigods took the form of bees, and they were flying around and circumambulating, and then that was the end of the pastime. Yeah, you know, it's short, but whatever. Yeah, but it was just done to, you know, he means for the species to exist, then the Lord has to establish it. He has to create it. You know, like that. So I think it was in Shrinya Purana. One of the Puranas mentioned, it's like one paragraph that describes that incarnation. So, you know, there must be all these incarnations, and they're just very, very quick. So there is. Yeah. Because it's his pastime, that's the thing. But we take it so seriously that it's our pastime. So it's like, you know, if we figure it out, you got a play going on, you know, you're trying to put on some drama, and one of the actors decides it's real and it's his thing and he's doing it and starts making up his own lines and everything. It's just a disturbance, you know. It's kind of like, hey, wake up, you know. You know, no, it's this and that. It says, hey, you know, it's just a drama. It's our drama. No, it's mine. So, you know, can't you see this? I mean, it's a problem. I can't get this blood out. It just won't come out. Hey, listen, give us a break. You know, so it's, these things are happening, you know, so that's what's going on. So it's just, you know, in the Vedic age, you had more people that understood their parts and a few lesser, you know, out to lunch actors. And in Kali Yuga, it's like the whole stage is out to lunch and, you know, one guy in the corner is going, hey, these guys missed the plot here. Okay, then, that assigned to each in the beginning clung to it spontaneously afterwards. Means as it is established, it always is there. It doesn't change. So this idea that it's changing and uplifting and getting better and all this, no. It's just the nature is the same. Like that. Means they may say that, you know, before the people were so uncivilized and they were rough with people and that, now the sophisticated man and all this. Yeah, all you need is a petrol shortage. And you see, they get out of their car and blow each other away. They get in a jam, and the guy behind him beeps too much or something, like they get out and blow him away. So that's civilized? Right? You know, the lights go off, there's a blackout for a couple of hours. I think it was like $1 billion damage done in New York. Right? India, they go off all the time, you know, and everybody, life goes on. Nothing's stolen, nothing's lost, nothing's damaged. You know, but India is backwards and, you know, the West is supposed to be, you know, progressive and sophisticated.
That's a good point.
Yeah. There's like in India, there's always petrol shortages and always this and that. Life goes on. No one kills each other. But in the West, they actually shoot each other. You know, some guy is like, he's got to get his wife to the hospital and all that, and so he cuts in front, and another redneck's there and pulls out his shotgun and blows him away, you know. So this goes on. So it's not that they're, you know, it's not that. They only say, so it's no different. It means that people are who they are. The only reason that they don't do something crazy is because the government's so strong and keeps them from doing it. You know, the government's weak, then you get a banana republic. Government's strong, then you get, you know, the first world country. Yeah, that's all. Because they know. It's just like in the first world, they know that there's enough people unemployed that unemployed people make trouble. So give them a little bit of money, they won't steal, but still they'll be bored. So you give them sports. Yeah, that's the thing. Betting games. Yeah, and then that. But at the same time, you don't want the good people to take the drugs because you want the country to go on. So you got to simultaneously stop it on one side but keep all the other guys busy. So it's a very delicate thing. But because it's politics, you can't bring that out in the open because a common person can't understand. You know? But because they don't have a set of standards established by God, therefore they use methods that may not be, that may give them reactions, may work good on one side but bad on the other. You know? So that kind of a thing you have to deal with. So that's the important thing, is that, in other words, it's going to establish that the, what nature it says is the nature of the Brahma, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, of Brahmachari, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, Sannyasa, and women. That's the way it is. It was created by God in the beginning. Every creation is like that, and throughout the creation it's consistent. It's not the beginning creation is one way, at the end it's another way, or the beginning of Kali Yuga is one way. No, it's always the same. Like that. It's just a matter of what level of purity you're working at. Yeah. As each season assumes distinctive marks, beings take up their fixed nature. You know, you call it summer because it's hot. You call it winter because it's cold. So that's the point. You call it a dog because it, you know, wags its tail and barks. You know, you call it a cat because it meows and, you know, claws you on the nose when you get too close. So, like that, then it gets its name. You know, you don't call the dog a fish, you know. Oh, nice fish you got here. That's not a fish, that's my dog. No, no, it's great. Okay, and then the final point of that is then God, from all this, to organize that into something that's applicable, then you get, this is the last one, for prosperity the four varnas appeared from his mouth, arms, thighs, and feet. So that's what's described in the Purusha Shukta. All this whole creation and the establishment of the Varnashram, that's all described in the Purusha Shukta. So Purusha Shukta then is establishing the whole thing. So that then ends the creation. So its connection, or the cause for it, is the good and bad. And then its actual practical manifestation of application is Varnashram. Does that make some sense? So we see how the creation is functioning. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Does the Lord give some feeling to Lord Rama in giving different names to different creatures and forms?
There's no need. The name's already perfect. Because the thing is, see, in Sanskrit, everything comes out of a root word. There's 2,000 root words. All the words go back to 2,000. Of that, 1,200 are prominent. And all those, basically most of those words are describing the activity, because everything's known by its activity. You know, a dog by it barks, or it wags its tail, or it, you know, slobbers all over you. Or, you know, like that. So you know it by the activity. So then everything starts out as an activity, because when you think of something, then you have the inherent desire to speak something that's coming from the root chakra. When it comes up to the navel, then the activity aspect of it is manifest. When it comes to the heart, then you transform it into actually a person, place, or thing. And then when it comes to the voice chakra, then you speak it. So every word is based as a verb, an activity. Right? And so what it does is what the name is given to it. So the Sanskrit names are scientific because the word itself
is actually what the thing does. Yeah. So why would you have to change something that's already perfect?
It means that every word has some meaning in subtle way and sometimes subtle.
Yes, subtle or gross, both. Means it just means it always has. It always, like you see, to do, you know, I think is like kri or something. There's a root word like that, to do, kri or something, kri or kara, something like that, I don't know, krit or something. So all of the things in the grammar that do something all start with that. So karakas start with that, because they're the nouns that actually are declined that do everything. You know, the verbs that actually do the activity are kriya, right? And the suffixes that connect to verbs that turn them into nouns that still basically act as verbs are called kridantas. So you can always tell what it is. If you know the language and know the grammar, then you can understand what everything, what it means, because it actually has an inherent meaning. So the thing itself has a name based on that. So it has an inherent name. So the nature of it's been inherently given, so its name is also given accordingly, because the language also comes from God. So this is just describing the Dharma aspect, so it doesn't get into the grammar aspect. Or doesn't get into the Jyotish, but it mentions the field that it's functioning from. So you can connect Jyotish to here.
I thought in different traditions they have different explanations. Like in the Bible, in Genesis, said that the God gave the freedom to man and woman to decide which future would have which name.
That's just they give their, according to their language, they give it a name. Mm-hmm. Because they were being kicked out from the Vedic society. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And then you go out and then you do what you like.
You know. Call the dog a fish.
Yeah, call them whatever you like. What do we care? Like that. But the principle is the same. As we see, as all these languages come. Many of the languages you can trace back. Even a lot of words. I think there's about 250, 300 words in English that you can trace back to Sanskrit. Like it mentioned, you see, I can think of one in the Gita where it mentions when they blew the conch shells and beat on the drums. It says tumulo.
Yeah, tumultuous.
Yeah, tumultuous. So it comes from there. So there's words that are like that. So some languages it's more direct. You know, especially the ones that are around here, you know, or over into the Middle East. Once you go into Europe and all that, it kind of gets lost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Danta, dental. Yeah.
Huh?
It's the same.
Yeah, to yoga means to connect like yoga.
Uh-huh. Oh, yoga. Yeah. So, does that make some sense? So, that's not the thing. The taste is the passion. Not the individual. He's not an artist. He's an engineer. You know what I'm saying? Artist wants to taste that creation. But he's still an instrument in it. If he's any good. Because they say, I'm inspired. Where did that inspiration come from? It means it didn't come from him. Because sometimes he's not inspired. You know? So that means is whatever the modes of nature give it to them, then it's happening. And when they don't, it doesn't. Right? Science means there's a method. And you just operate it. Still, your ability to operate and understand, that's still also coming from the Lord, coming from the modes of nature. But it's not an art, it's a science. Application, still there's an art to it. But it's based on the science. So, if you go back, you know, even in the modern, then you go back some time, it was still based on the science of aesthetics. But nowadays, it's kind of anything goes. You know, does that make some sense? So, you know, the ones that some of them have started this modern art, they themselves were expert in the classical art. So based on those principles, they did their modern art. And now people learn art without knowing those principles. And therefore, nobody will pay a few $1 million for their work. You know, I mean, anybody would throw some paint, ride a bicycle over it, ride around on it, you know, eat lunch there. You know, I mean, okay, nice, but, you know, nobody's paying that serious of money for it. You know, those paintings aren't in the Louvre.
I read in one article in the newspaper in Spain, somewhere in Cetis, there was this dictatorship of everything in the Cetis. And so this. Yes, something like that. So this. So this modern art, you know, like this black, you know, square, something like that. So they used it as some kind of torture in jail.
You know, they just put that on the wall.
Yeah. You know, or
all the rule, or the whole wall. Yeah.
So they say, you know, that such kind of art is originally came from that time. You know. Spanish jail.
I mean, they just put that in music all the time. Anything but that music.
Also, the most pious living entity, he becomes Brahma. So by nature, that they're garment and they become very popular.
Yeah, that's a good point. Means they're interested in doing it properly. So properly is according to the rules. So that he's the one who's most inclined to do things according to the rules. Therefore he's done. His point is God already made it. He just has to manufacture it. You know? God already created the concept of cooking. He's made the fire. He's made the pots. He's made the vegetables. You know, he's made the recipe. So now all you have to do is then follow the recipe and come up with a preparation. But it's already been made by the Lord. So just, therefore, he's the most expert at following.
Because it's software. It doesn't mean the software, and the issue of the software is.
Yeah.
That makes it.
Yeah.
Or takes or aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Does that make some sense? That's.
It means. Sadhyas.
Sadhyas, from my know of, they're the you know, highly elevated sages and stuff that I know. Is that the sadhyas?
I'm sure if you check it out.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Does that mean he created the individuals or created what is?
The concept of, like that, because means you always have a Bhrigu, you always have a, you know, Ushnas, you always have a Brihaspati, you always have Vishishta, you have, but different souls may take that up. So every creation, they're there.
So could you say that he created
the whole? Yeah, like that. It's just like he creates the demigods, but a different souls there every time there's a change of manas. Like that. Indra is always there, but 14 times in a day of Brahma, the new jiva is Indra. Mm-hmm. You know, and that happens every day, so that means there's, you know, there's quite a few thousands. Yeah. So like that. So then, but the post of Indra has been created. What his abilities are, what his potency are, what his mentality is, what his facilities are, what his enjoyment is, what his planet will look like, what, you know, what everything that he has about it. It'll already be created. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's the point, that it's so amazing and vast and variety that we become bewildered by it. But that's what it is. That's why it says chewing the chew. It's the same old thing. You know? Yeah. Because there the same thing, even though it has its inherent nature, has unlimited ways to express within, because all the different combinations. It is the same way as you have seven notes,
you can put it together in so many ways because you have so many aspects of it. How long you hold it, how you move between it, you know, what is the beat, the meter between them, like that. So in this way you come up with so much. You know, you hear just a few you know, moments of a tune and you can pick the tune, what it is, who wrote it, when, you know, like this. And that's just within our experience. And that's working on grosser Western systems. So you can imagine where in the Vedic system, where the actual, the seven notes have 22 different places they can be placed. Because you're dealing with quarter notes. Mm. Like that. The West has seven notes and five half notes in between. So that's 12. But then the Vedic, there's another 10 quarter notes added to that. So then the particular movement of those notes then creates moods. Moods, seasons. Like that. So then so that becomes even more far out. Does that make some sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then within that, then you hear like a Indian musician, they'll play the same raga, they could play it every day for a year and every time it would be a little different. But there's certain elements that are always the same, but that's what makes it that raga. Right. The particular notes that are used, and there's a certain phrase. There's a way that the notes can move, and there's a certain like signature phrase that it always comes back to. Then you know it's that raga. Like Rama Rama Hare Hare, that's the signature of that particular morning aspect of the morning rock. You know, so Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare, Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. It always comes back to that. So that's how you know that it's that rock, is by the notes that it uses and that signature. Like that. So that's how those good musicians or music critics, then just within the first, even sometimes the first note, how you use the first note, they can tell you what raga it is. Because the note there means is what gets you to the note. You start with sa. And all they're doing is playing sa for the first so many minutes generally. But sa means where you're ending at. You know, you want to get, you know, sa, you know, you can go sa, you know, you go ni da, ni sa. But that's still called sa, because that's the way sa works in that raga. It'll work that way. So then that's called sa, because in another one it won't have that. You know, it'll be a different movement. So you can tell how they use the note. You know, how they emphasize it and all that. That's how they get their variety. It doesn't have to be so gross like the Western. So, therefore, with that subtlety, then there's even more variety. So it's unlimited. It's just a few notes. So, therefore, each rasa is so perfect because it's been created by Krishna. There's unlimited variety within it, even though it has a particular field to move in. Like that. So then Krishna can always get that taste from each rasa, unlimitedly. Does that make sense? That's it. So he's just created like that. You know, if you needed 100 notes to get variety, then there'd be 100 notes, but you only need 7. So Krishna created like that. And the 7 actually go back to 3. And then the Veda. You know, you have the middle note, the above it and below it. Sarita, Udata, and Anudata. So from each of them then come all the other notes. Like that. And so they have those other notes inherently in them. Like that. So like that you get the sounds. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Okay. So then, now we'll go back, then we'll go to, so then, today's what, Monday, and Friday we'll do the, start with the secondary creation and then see if we get it through any quickly. So, yeah. So as we go through, then we're dealing with the, you know, the overall principles and all that. Once we get that all down, then it will go back into the verses themselves. You know, then it'll be more clear. We can read through it, the details will be more clear. Because the idea is, if you go into the main work, until certain principles are understood, it won't really make much sense. And then there'll be so much discussion that you won't get the flow of the work. So here, we go through the outline. It's small enough, you can see, okay, this is the primary creation.
Right.
But that will be dealt with in, let's say, 30, 40 verses. So if you have to discuss like this in each thing, in that 30, 40 verses will cover many pages, you can't keep an overview of it. You know? So even if this goes, you know, slowly through all this, but you can still, the idea is to get an overview of the whole thing so you can understand it. Then when we go into it, do the main verses, then we'll be able to keep that focus because we already have the background. So,
what's the Manusamhita?
This is Manusamhita.
Can we also see the Manusamhita, all these topics, in relationship to Pensadi Sachinabhagavatam?
Yeah, you could. Yeah, I'm sure you could. But that's generally the 10 subjects are, it means you could, but when it's presented through 10 subjects, then that's called Purana. It's called Mahapurana.
Mm.
When it's through 5, then it's called Purana. Dharmashastra. So Dharmashastra is an expansion of the Dharma Sutras, which are an expanded derivative of the Brahmanas. The Brahmanas are how to use the Samhita of the Samhita, the mantras of the Veda, in ritual. To perform that ritual, then you have the Dharma and the Griha Sutras. So the Dharma Sutras, you get the Dharma Shastra, the Griha Sutras, then you get the actual samskars. No, it's not part of Itihasa. Itihasa is part of Purana. Purana means it deals with the same thing, the creation, the secondary creation, then the Prajapatis, then the Manus, then the kings, but all of them. But when you choose just one king and deal with him only, or one person and deal with them only, that's an itihas. Like Ramayana is an itihas. It's just about Lord Ramachandra. But Bhagavatam, you see, deals with everybody, including Ramachandra. Like that. Or the Pandavas, that's Mahabharata. It's an itihas on Pandavas. But the Bhagavatam being a Purana, it describes the Pandavas. So that is just, it's a subsection of Purana. No. Manusamhita is a separate book of knowledge.
Separate of the four Vedas.
Means there's 14 books of Vedic knowledge. The four Vedas are 4 of them. Right? So that's 4. Then the next 4 are dealing with Sanskrit. So you have Siksha, means how to pronounce the words. Chanda, what's the meter of the words. Vyakaran is what's the grammar of the words. And Nirukta, which is the definition of the words, the vocabulary. Then you have Kalpa, which is how to apply the Vedic words into ritual. It means the Sanskrit, so you can read it and understand it and pronounce it. Then next is Kalpa, then the ritual is applied in ritual. Then the next after that is Jyotish, means to do ritual you need a proper time to do it at. So you have to know how to calculate the proper muhurta. Then after that, then you have to understand what does the Veda actually mean. So you have to mimamsa, what's your interpretation of it. So that's where your philosophy comes in. Then there's those who have lived it and applied it, how to understand how to apply all that, the Veda, and that's the Purana. Right? Then what are the rules by which those who apply the Veda live? That's the Dharmashastra. And then what is the method of thinking and discussing and interaction? That's Nyaya, that's logic. So that's the 14 books.
Where is the Ayurveda coming in?
Ayurveda is an Upapurana. So the Puranas, then there's four subsections. Is that so? Ayurveda is one, Gandharva Veda, which is music, drama, and dance, Sthapana Veda, which is architecture and, you know, city planning, and Dhamma Veda, which is the martial science. Yeah, I mean, that's how the academy's curriculum is set up. Like that. We just use that same, but we just condense it. We take it as 8 subjects. There's 14 books, but in 8 subjects. Because when we learn Veda, we learn the different mantras and that together. So just which ones we learn, that becomes one subject, is mantra. Sanskrit has those 4 parts, so we just call it Sanskrit. Like that. So basically then that cuts the 8 down to 2. And then that leaves you 6, so you end up with 8. 8 main topics. So that's how the school's curriculum is organized. It means this class that you're going through now will go through all 14 of these books. Like that. And there's subsections and everything. Because each one has subsections. The Veda has 4 subsections. That's not really Ajrasamahitarva. That means within one of them they have the Samhita, which is the verses themselves, the Brahmanas, which explains how to apply it in ritual, the Aranyakas explain the metaphysics behind those rituals, and the Upanishads explains the philosophy. Like that. So then, basically, everything connects back to those. Like that. You know, your Vedanta comes out of the Upanishads, and much of all your sciences and everything. And they come out of these others, the Brahmanas, Aranyakas, or Upanishads. Yeah, Tarva Veda also has so many of the sciences. I think especially the Upavedas. They come out of it. Yeah. But each Upaveda then connects to these 4 Vedas. And then the Puranas are the 5th Veda. Like that. And so then your Dharma Shastras will connect down there, your logic will be out of the Upanishads. So you can just take the 4 Vedas and connect all the branches of knowledge to it. But within the Veda itself, there's 14 aspects of it. You know? Yeah. So it can be, depending on your purpose, you can put it together in different ways. But still, the topics are the same, 14. Like that. And then each has its subsections. You know, like you take the 6... Yeah, each that I know of, each of the 6 the 6 Vedangas, each has 6 parts. Like that. You know, so like that, then you end up with a lot. So that's 36 right there. And then the Vedas have 4 parts. So 4 Vedas and 4 each, that's 16. You know, so 16 and 36, that's 48. And then we have the last 4. And then Purana has so many subsections. Like that. Okay. So then on Friday, then we'll continue with the secondary creation. And then carry on. Okay. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinda ki, Janita Gaura Premanandi.